Hi, everybody. It's Nat and Allie here coming in before the episode starts, just to give a quick content warning. Our conversation today does include some discussion of domestic violence and child abuse. So if that is something that could potentially be triggering for you, you may want to skip this episode since it is a large part of the conversation. If you or anyone you know is suffering from domestic violence, there's always help. You can reach out to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 800-799-7233. Again, that's 800-799-7233. Or text START to 88788.
Heartbreak opens onto the sunrise. For even breaking is opening, and I am broken. I'm open. Broken to the new light without pushing in. Open to the possibilities within pushing out. See the love shine in through my cracks. See the light shine out through me. I am broken. I am open. I am broken open. See the love light shining through me, shining through my cracks, through the gaps. My spirit takes journey. My spirit takes flight. Could not have risen otherwise. And I am not running. I am choosing. Running is not a choice from the breaking. Breaking is freeing. Broken is freedom. I am not broken. I am free.
This is Snails and Oysters.
Hello, and welcome to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bi-sexual movie podcast. I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers. Well, this week, I'm back in New York, so we're truly bi-coastal once again.
True. We're back to actually living up to our name.
Right, being true to the ethos of the podcast.
Exactly. Duality. This is unofficially a Taoist podcast. How was your stay in LA? How did you like my current home?
I truly loved it. I truly feel a little basic for loving it, but I did. There's nothing wrong. Well, actually, that's not true. There's a few things.
Oh,
I have some notes.
If you want to write those up in an email to me, I'll pass them along to the appropriate authorities.
Oh, thank you. And now I'm back in New York. Saw a roach within the first 24 hours, and I'm definitely back, baby.
Country roads take me home.
Yeah. How was your week?
Actually, I had a specter cast over the past few months, actually. A specter known as long Furbies.
What?
Are you familiar with this concept?
No, but I am extremely suspect.
You should be, because so this actually, this is about to be a call out track for my friend Molly, who I don't know if she actually listens, but if you are listening, Molly,
she better.
I finally had enough. I'm coming for you. Because, you know, I'm not on TikTok, but I have friends who send me TikToks, and I'm in a group chat with Molly where people send TikToks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And every so often, she'll sneak in a long Furby video, and I'm going to send you one of these, and I want you to tell our listeners, to the best of your ability, what it is.
Okay. I'm so afraid.
What would you call that?
This is a Furby with the legs of a spider, robotic spider insect legs holding a sword.
Yep.
It's like a scarier, worse Furby.
Yep.
I don't hate it.
Oh, don't worry. I sent you the safest one first.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh no. Oh, what's
So while Allie is experiencing this, Molly will send these to the group chat and specifically like put them in a text so that the preview doesn't come up. So we're never quite sure if it's a long Furby video. She'll hide the preview, and sometimes she doesn't send these. Sometimes it's animal videos or something funny or a dance trend. What was that last one?
I hate that. That was a little Furby being cut in half and revealing baked beans on its insides.
Baked beans.
I don't understand what it what long Furby is, but I'm just searching the hashtag now.
Well, here, I have one more that Molly sent for you to see.
Okay. Oh, no. No, 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 no. That video was the face of a Furby being put on a bagel sandwich on top of two slices of turkey. And do you, I don't understand the long Furby phenomenon. Do you?
Me neither. It's like Furby modification.
It kind of feels very surrealist to me. But I say that and it kind of makes my stomach clench up watching these vids.
Yeah. So I didn't really have a punchline in mind. I just have been in so much pain since seeing these. And now I had to spread it. Oh, my God. Is this what happened to Molly?
Yeah.
Someone introduced this to her and now she became like a plague carrier. And now it's, God, am I going to get a TikTok and just start? So that had nothing to do with anything, but this week's episode.
If you want the cinematic opposite of long Furbies, which is like beautiful, heartwarming, that's full of meaning, unlike long Furbies, which really are nihilistic content.
Honestly, yeah.
Pariah is a film.
Gives you the opposite feeling of a long Furby video. You know what it is? It's during Pariah you cry, but afterwards you feel good. During a long Furby video you laugh, and afterwards you have night terrors.
Yeah.
So without further ado, let's get away from this godforsaken topic as quickly as possible and start talking about Pariah.
Let's go. Pariah is a 2011 film written and directed by Dee Reese. It's about Alike, a Black teenager, and her friend, Laura. And it's really about their friendship. Laura is a more self-assured, confident, butch lesbian, and Alike is more timid, shy, trying to figure out who she is in terms of her sexual orientation and her gender presentation.
Alike, also known as Lee throughout the film, is not out to her conservative parents, Arthur, who is a police officer, and Audrey, who works in healthcare. Audrey is a devout Christian and has a very strained relationship with her eldest daughter because of Alike's more androgynous gender presentation, while her father Arthur frequently works night shifts and so is physically absent but has a closer friendship with his daughter.
Yeah, her mother's disapproval, she kind of locates it onto her friendship with Laura because Laura is the more out butch lesbian. And so Audrey sets her up on a kind of friend date with her coworker's daughter, Bina.
To all appearances, Bina is the opposite of Alike. She presents very femme. She fits in at school. She's, has a solid relationship with her mother from what we can tell. And at first, Alike wants nothing to do with Bina whatsoever. But over the course of several weeks of just sort of being forced to spend time together, they actually discover several common interests, like in hardcore rock music and rap, and develop a genuine friendship.
So Alike and Bina's friendship evolves into something a little more. They share a kiss, and then a day or two later, they end up spending the night together, and Alike loses her virginity. In the morning, she kind of assumes that now they're an item, or at least that Bina is into her and interested in doing this again. And Bina really harshly rejects that and says, "We're just playing. I'm not really gay."
Alike takes this rejection really hard, goes home, destroys her bedroom, cries the rest of the night. And then later, when she overhears an argument between her parents about her sexuality, she goes downstairs and comes out to them. And it's actually quite a brutal scene because her mother physically attacks her.
Yeah.
Which is, it's very tough to watch. But we'll get into that.
So after these two really devastating scenes, Alike actually moves in with Laura. And then, like, this is the ending of the film. What's that called, Nat? The, like, denouement?
Yeah.
Yeah, the denouement. This is, and things happen really quickly from here, where Alike is accepted into an early college program in California. And despite her father's attempt to reconcile and welcome her back into the house, she's made a decision to be done and to start her life on her own. So even though the end of the movie has these really traumatic scenes, it ends on a real note of like resilience. It ends with her on a bus
heading to California, reciting a poem. We haven't mentioned yet that she is a poet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get to, yeah. Throughout the movie, there are various subplots, both about Elique's writing and her close friendship with one of her teachers. Also, Laura's attempts to get her GED and Elique's parents' marriage falling apart due to her dad's implied infidelity.
Yeah.
Pariah debuted at the 2011 Sundance Film Festival, where it won awards for cinematography and general acclaim for its performances and writing. This is the movie that really launched Dee Reese as a writer and director and Adepero Adoya as an actress.
The film is now part of the Criterion Collection, and in 2021, it was number 3 on Autostraddle's top 200 LGBTQ plus films of all time.
So let's get into it.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is such a good movie. I had never seen it before, so I am very excited to talk about it with you today.
Yeah, I think this is either the third, or I'm pretty sure it's the fourth time I've seen it. Wow. I love this movie. Yeah, I love this film. I've been really, really excited to share it with you because not only because I just think it's an incredible film, especially it was Dee Reese's first film.
Yeah.
Her first feature.
The fact that this is her debut, like feature debut, that's insane to me because this movie is so well made.
Yeah. I read a review earlier that called it self-assured, and I think that's a really good, there's so many other things about this film, but it really does have such a like strong center of gravity, I think.
Yeah.
And really knows what it wants.
It just feels very much like itself. Like it doesn't feel like it feels influenced by other filmmakers without feeling like it's copying anybody, which a lot of first films can feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. And I just love it. Every time I watch it, I'm so struck by how real all of the characters feel.
Yeah.
And how incredible the dialogue is.
Yeah.
So struck by how funny the script is, even in like really painful moments. There's a lot of humor. And it's such a world that's built up over the course of, it's not long, it's like an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's a very short film, and yet it manages to pack like quite a punch.
Yeah.
When was the first time you saw it? Do you remember?
I think I was in high school in junior or senior year. And I think I was kind of like looking to watch more like filmy films, you know?
Yeah.
And
films with a capital F.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, since it was 2011, I either would have just graduated high school or had just been on college. And it's funny watching it now. There's so many references that feel just a little bit dated.
Sure.
And now in 2022, like burning a mix CD and
the flip phones. Oh, the flip phones.
But yeah, I remember it definitely made me cry. And
yeah.
I just remember feeling so like so impressed by the way that it is a tragic film, but the main character, Elique, is not a victim of tragedy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, I guess like, or not, like, I don't even want to use the word victim or not use it anyone. But like, I think what I mean is the film is so much about her resilience and her self-discovery and in the face of like
enormous adversity in some instances.
Enormous adversity. Yeah. It's really triumphant in that way. Like, I think it's kind of a triumphant tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. And not in a way, I think a lot of times triumph can be used to describe mawkish or saccharine films, but this one feels like it feels like a real triumph because it feels earned and it feels real. It feels very rooted. It doesn't feel like a film ending.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a very honest and true story,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense. I saw an interview with Dee Reese where she said that it is semi-autobiographical. She herself is, you know, a Black lesbian who was once a teenager and had parents who were not immediately accepting of her sexuality.
Mm.
So yeah, let's get into it because I had never seen this film before. This is my first time seeing it. I think I had heard the name and knew very little about it other than that. I don't think I even knew that Dee Reese directed it. I just sort of heard the name around. First, let me start the episode by saying thank you for getting me to watch this movie because it's fucking fantastic.
I'm always trying to get people to watch this movie. Yeah,
I can see why. It's really good. I think we've talked before about movies set in New York because, you know, you and I both lived, you still live and I lived many years in New York. And I think I've said before that I think any movie set in New York has to create its own New York. It has to build, it has to construct the little microcosm that it's going to be set in. Otherwise, it will just sort of evaporate or feel like a set or not feel true to any sort of reality.
Yeah.
And this movie definitely does a good job of drilling down into its particular understanding of New York, like its particular sub biome within the city.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely like the different spaces have such a feel to them.
Yeah.
Like Alike's house has such a feeling of both familiar, you know, family dynamics, but also extreme tension and stress. Yeah. There's so many moments in the film where Audrey, her mother, is, you know, passive aggressively talking to her father, or like things are being whispered about that Alike and her sister aren't supposed to hear, but obviously they can hear.
Yeah.
And so that's like such its own environment. But then there's also the environment of like Alike's school, yeah, which is like a really kind of fun place of discovery with her peers and her teacher, her English teacher, who really supports her.
Yeah.
I feel like each space kind of gives Alike an opportunity to either close down protectively or open up and explore. Like, that's definitely the function of the strip club, dance club that they go to. I forget what it's called. I think it's called
like the litter box. The litter box.
I think that
I don't know that the name is, the actual name is ever said.
Right. I think at some point someone derisively says, it's the litter box, but I think it's probably like a different, but it creates its own New York for sure.
Yeah. And like you were saying, each of those spaces is an opportunity for Alike to try on a different identity, a different self presentation at the very least. And it's interesting that the movie does make a point of focusing on the ways that she performs her identities. You know, a lot of emphasis is placed on her changing clothes between home and school so that she doesn't have to wear the very frilly femme clothes that her mother picks out for her in front of her peers. And then going to the club with Laura, she changes even more into a much more butch presentation. And that's actually where we're introduced to her, is at the club with Laura, wearing like very mask clothing, like a very androgynous presentation. It's a really interesting choice to start the film there, because the bar that she and Laura go to in some ways emulates a hetero strip club with the stage and the patrons throwing money on the stage. But, you know, the patrons are mostly butch lesbians rather than straight men, which just completely shifts the power dynamic in the room. But it's still this like hyper aggressive, pulsing sort of atmosphere.
Yeah. And there's still just like kind of a club mentality to it that you can tell Alike is struggling to fit into. And that's the other thing I love so much about this film. It's so much about trying to figure out who you are through different spaces and different people.
Yeah.
And also about how limited your choices can be when you're younger. Like, I think sometimes when you're younger, you don't find your people, you know, and because you literally are limited to like 100 people or whatever, you know, it's like whatever little pool, whatever little ecosystem you're in, is kind of it. And like, I think sometimes that leads to trying to fit into certain scenes, or like, you can tell that she's trying so hard to like be like her friend Laura.
Right. Dress like her, behave like her.
But that's not who she really is. Like, she's not really, like, by the end of the film, you get the sense she's someone who wants to go to a poetry open mic on the weekend way more than she wants to go to a club and hit on women.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting arc throughout the movie. Just like in terms of costume design, there's a really interesting presentation of call it a thesis of the feminine clothes that her mother sort of forces her to wear out versus the antithesis of the butch clothing that Laura helps her buy and that she does seem to be more comfortable in, but maybe not 100% comfortable. And then by the end, there's a sort of synthesis where she's in just sort of androgynous clothes, just flannels and jeans rather than, you know, undershirts and snapback caps, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the film is really good at using those subtle clues to express her internal journey.
Totally. And I want to bring up a really one of the examples of the script's humor
yeah.
that happens early on that has to do with how she dresses. So Alike is at school and hears some girls talking about this club and talking about, you know, oh, could you ever be into a woman? And
one of her classmates is like, yeah, you know, I'd be dead. This is actually the one time that bisexuality is explicitly mentioned in the film. Is like one of them is like, girl, you're talking like you're bi. And she says, hey, I like women. Even if I love men.
Yes, yeah. And she looks over at Alike and says, oh, she's really cute, but like not quite as hard as, you know, she could be harder. And that's kind of like, you know, implies that Alike could be a little more masculine presenting.
A little tougher,
and so, a little tougher, yeah. And directly after that, Alike asks Laura if she can get her a strap-on.
Yeah.
Or like, it's not, it's, yeah, it's like a...
Yeah, it's a strap-on, yeah.
Yeah, it's a strap-on, and... This part of the movie was so funny to me because it wasn't that long ago that if you wanted something embarrassing to buy, you had to literally go into a store and get it. Like now, anything embarrassing you could want, you can order.
Just go to Extreme Just go to extremerestraints.com.
Yeah. We are sponsored by extremerestraints.com.
Yeah. Well, hey, we are always looking for new sponsors. So if you or anyone you know works at Extreme Restraints, we're here for you, baby.
But like the point is, it's a really humorous moment because Laura, it takes like a week for her to go to the store and get it. She gets a white one. So Alike is standing there in the mirror like, this looks completely ridiculous.
And it's like bunched up over her boxers and like,
yeah.
And the two of them are just arguing like it's a Seinfeld episode all of a sudden of like, take it back. Yes. I can't take it back. I don't want to go back there.
Yeah, it's seriously so funny. And a really great example too of a moment where Alike is really trying to figure out what's going to make me feel most like myself, most confident.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think Dee Reese actually said that that's her favorite scene in the movie, too. So I'm glad you picked up on it, because I also love that scene, because I think it also it shows this movie's really masterful control of tone, because that scene can coexist with some of the darker scenes that we'll get to and feel very natural. And I think that that's more accurate to life, especially life as a queer person. There's a lot of awkwardness and a lot of humor in it, as well as, you know, some tragedy, some brutality, but also lighter moments. And to try to portray life as just one or just the other is never fully felt honest to me. I think that's why I'm drawn to films like this and films like Billy Wilder movies, ones that can balance humor and drama.
Totally.
Yeah. That's also, I believe that scene also ends with Alike's younger sister. Sharonda. That scene also ends with Alike's younger sister, Sharonda, walking in on them. And it's a very, it's actually quite a sweet moment between siblings, because it's like, I'm telling, no, don't, like, oh, give me back my makeup and I won't tell, and like things like that.
Yeah.
And it's really sweet, actually, because it's like a very like joshing sort of scene.
Yeah.
But what's particularly interesting is how the humor and that sort of sibling dynamic goes cold the minute Alike's mother walks in.
Yeah.
Like, fortunately, Alike is able to hide the strap on before her mother walks in.
That would have been bad.
Yeah, that would have been bad. But yeah, it just, it's her arrival just sends like a chill through the room, the way that an abusive parent can, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, Laura immediately goes into yes, ma'am mode, trying to seem like a good friend, because she is, but there's just nothing she can do. Yeah. Do you want to talk a bit about Alike's mom?
Yeah, I think Alike's mom is also, I'm just going to use the word tragic again. I think she's a tragic figure. And I don't say that like to minimize her abuse of Alike. I just say that in that I think she's really, really well portrayed as a woman who is really alienated from her husband, who seems to be very clearly lying to her. And if he's not lying to her, he's definitely created distance. There's distance in their relationship. And she's also a mom who's going through the really natural but painful, I think, part of raising children, which is when they get to an age where they start to push away from you. And that really challenges your identity as a mother. And she wants to feel connected to her daughter. And she's also homophobic.
Yeah. That's the thing. I think Yeah, on top of all of those very natural things like feeling alienated in marriage and feeling disconnected from your child, she's also the prisoner of her own prejudice. Like she.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah. She is even further not able to connect with Alike because she's unwilling to accept who Alike really is. I think at one point, actually, when later in the film, Alike comes home late and her mother's yelling at her, she says, "I'm not your husband, so stop yelling at me instead of him. I'm not your companion. You made that clear a long time ago."
I love that. Yeah. I love that dialogue.
I think it really reveals the relationship, which is that Alike could have been a source of comfort to her mother, but instead her mother... Her mother's own bigotry gets in the way of that. And I think that that's really the core of Audrey's character, is that she isolates herself with her own drive for perfection, which, you know, if you want to, there's an old saying, like, it takes 100 years for a family to get fucked up. you could definitely read Audrey's character as somebody who is also the product of an abusive household because of the way she strives for the image of perfection, if not the reality. And she has this sort of, like, subcurrent of vitriol that bursts out when she can't control it anymore, and then she immediately represses again. Like we see it at work too. Like she has no friends at her workplace. Like people leave the room when she walks in.
Yeah.
And so honestly, she reminds me, in a weird way, she reminds me of Judge Frollo from The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh my God.
Does that make any sense? Because it's like,
I mean, it's definitely, you have officially won the award of most random like comparison, but I see. Well, let me talk through it.
Because Frollo, in my opinion, Frollo is one of the best Disney villains because he doesn't enjoy being a villain. He is very tormented and angry and upset, but is still a monster.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious example is his villain song. Most Disney villain songs are like, haha, yeah, I love being the bad guy. But instead, Frollo's song is Hellfire, where he's singing about how he feels the devil is dragging him to hell because he can't control his lust for Esmeralda. This was a kid's movie.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
This was literally the scariest kid's movie.
Yeah. But in a similar way, I think that Audrey is a deeply unhappy person.
Yeah.
But she sublimates that unhappiness into abuse.
Yeah.
You know, which frankly makes it a much more complex portrait and a much more accurate portrait, frankly, of domestic abuse, because abusers are often injured individuals. Like that's how you end up doing that. But as the old saying goes, your abuser's trauma doesn't justify the way they traumatize you.
Yeah. And I think the performance is so wonderfully complex.
Kim Wayans plays Audrey.
Yeah, I wanted to give her a shout out because I think in the hands of a different actor, this could have become a really one-note, homophobic, evil mother.
Yeah.
As opposed to being an abusive mother, but also complex person.
Yeah.
What I also think is really interesting is I feel like this film kind of shows how heteronormativity can maybe be enforced differently by like mothers versus fathers, because the mother kind of has the role of keeping, the mother is the traditional more domestic role of kind of policing the family from within, while Alike's father actually goes out into the world and is kind of has actual conversations with people where they are kind of like, hey, you know, your daughter has been hanging out around that, you know, that club, and they kind of confront him. And so then he's kind of confronted by the outside world.
Yeah.
Is kind of like encouraged by those interactions, or not encouraged, but pushed by those interactions to go back home and police his family because of these external forces. And I feel like it does a really good job of showing two kind of really different strains of homophobia, the kind that can be like really internal. And for Audrey, it is rooted in her religion, and then the kinds that can really just be about not wanting to endure a certain kind of social derision and wanting to conform, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's hitting the nail on the head. You know, it's the ways that heteronormativity enforces itself. It's never just one. And I think this movie does a really good job of showing how it's a larger system of oppression that is reinforced through a thousand, you know, death by a thousand cuts rather than one big thing. which is what allows there to be so much space for Kim Wayans' performance as Audrey, because we see the other forms of homophobia. So we don't put it all on her. So we're able to see the other notes of her character.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a really heartbreaking performance, because it gives you just enough that you understand why Alike still wants a relationship with her mother up until pretty much the end.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's really, I mean, insane about the performance is, I remember the first time I watched it, I was shocked. I really didn't expect that relationship to devolve into physical violence. I didn't expect Audrey to hit Alike and B, viciously. I mean, for the final, I think 20 minutes of the film, Alike has a really bad cut on her face that's slowly healing. And they make a point to show that it's not healing quickly.
Yeah. I think that's a very good visual metaphor as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. It. Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, it's a really shocking moment, and
But it also feels like sort of this inevitable culmination of the tension that's been building the whole time.
Yeah, right. Because really throughout the whole film, Audrey has been asking her husband to talk to Alike about this being, is she a lesbian?
Yeah.
And really insisting. And it's kind of honestly counterintuitive. Like, well, if you're going to be that upset about it, why are you trying so hard to find out?
Yeah.
What you know is true is true.
And it feels like the whole movie up until that point has been almost a duel between Alike and Audrey, where they're trying various techniques to force the other to have this conversation explicitly first, to make the first move, to say it first.
Yes. Yeah.
Audrey is using proxies. She's trying to get Arthur to ask. She's trying, you know, she's setting Alike up with Bina as a friend. She's isolating her from Laura. She's doing all of these things to try to force Alike to either stop being a lesbian or admit that she is and be driven out of the house. Meanwhile, Alike is code switching in front of her mom. She's dodging questions. She's not correcting people when they assume things until she finally can't take it anymore.
Yeah. I would love to dive into the bisexuality in Bina.
Yeah.
Unless, is there more you want to talk about, more just from the film point of view?
I'd love to talk about Alike's dad for a minute, because we've touched on him a bit.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Definitely.
He's an equally interesting figure, because I don't think, like, obviously no family exists in a vacuum, and no member of any family exists in a vacuum. And so I think Charles Parnell does an incredible job performing an enabler.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, in many ways, he is an enabler, because he wants to be the good guy. And so even if he is really harsh to his wife in a lot of scenes, like really terrible, frankly, telling her to shut up and things like that, he's still not willing to be the bad guy. He's like, it's heavily implied, if not outright said, he's having an affair, but he's not willing to leave his family.
Yeah.
He's not willing to talk to Alike about her sexuality, because he doesn't want to put her in an awkward position. He doesn't want there to be a problem. That's the thing. I think there's a great scene where the family's headed to church and he's just returned from the night shift, and Alike and her mom are fighting about what Alike has to wear to church. And I think that the scene ends with him saying, "Everyone looks beautiful. Please go away," basically is what he says.
Yeah.
That is part of the dynamic with somebody like Audrey, is to have somebody like Arthur. And he really, I think in the end, he partially reconciles with Alike, but he's still trying to pacify. He's still trying to enable. He's still trying to be like, let's all be in one house and pretend we're a happy family. So, it's just a really interesting performance, because I don't know that you would expect that from a father figure in American media.
Yeah, it's funny. I've never thought of him before as an enabler, but it makes a lot of sense now that you're saying it. I always just really saw him as avoidant in a way that I do think sometimes the media portrayal of American fathers can be a bit like, they're at work, they're distant, they're avoidant, they're not in the day-to-day problems of their children and they're a little bit like, don't bother me, I want a beer with my spaghetti, which is a hilarious like thing that he eats because he's like, it's good.
Yeah.
It's like, that's crazy to me. Anyways, it's good, just have wine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always just thought of him as avoidant, as really avoiding this question about Alike in a way that I think he thinks is for the best.
Yeah.
But I think is actively actually harmful given the internal dynamics of the home. And also given like there's a really heartbreaking conversation that Alike has with him after Bina kisses her for the first time, where she says, you know, what do you do if someone likes you and they're a friend?
Yeah.
And he says, well, I think the best things start out as friendships. And then he says, who is he?
Yeah. That's it. It goes from being a very sweet scene between a father and a daughter to, again, it's like throwing a bucket of ice, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it gets even worse because then he says, you know, you don't hang out at that club, do you?
Right.
He's given this moment. He's actually presented with a beautiful opportunity to learn more about Alike and to answer this question that his wife has been banging down his door about. And he chooses instead to A, assume she's straight.
Yeah.
And B, really manipulatively ask the question.
I think he claims that it's not a safe neighborhood, that the club is not in a safe neighborhood, right? And you don't want to mix around with that element.
That element. Yeah.
Very euphemistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he also has a line in that scene where he's like, your mother will be so relieved, when he's assumed that she has a boyfriend.
Yes. And it's just brutal.
Yeah. It's just brutal. That's the thing. It's, I think a lot of times people think good writing is this or good writing is that. What this film really showcases is that good writing is about writing really fragile characters well.
Hmm.
Because I think the family dynamic in this film is so tenuous at the start, and it collapses in such a real way.
Yeah.
That is so hard to execute. Like to make that believable, to make that tension believable, could easily descend into paper thin caricatures of people rather than something that feels real. And so, I don't really have anything intelligent to say other than that this movie fucking rocks.
Yeah. I mean, just everyone should watch it.
I think I think that the word that kept coming to me while watching this movie was the idea of just being love starved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think every character in this film doesn't feel loved enough or isn't being loved the way that they want to be. You know, Alike for sure. And, you know, that's what it just makes everything that happens to her so heartbreaking, because you see this vulnerable young woman who just really wants to be loved and accepted.
Yeah.
And then, you know, her mother, who is, you know, sort of 20 years down that same road of just not being loved. And it has turned her into this sort of monster. And then, you know, her dad as well feels like he isn't getting what he wants out of life. Laura certainly doesn't seem to be getting the love she needs. There's a really heartbreaking scene with her mother where she tries to reconnect after she gets her GED. Just all of these characters are just trying to connect.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really smart to the film's theme, because it's these systems of oppression that keep them apart. It's the it's homophobia in most cases that keep them from being able to connect to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. But I really want to talk about the bisexuality, because one of the reasons I really wanted to watch this film for this season is I feel like in a lot of our show, we've been kind of trying to talk about ways in which like the portrayal of bisexuality is inaccurate and harmful.
Yeah.
I think especially season one, we did that.
Yeah. The Barbarellas of the world.
The Barbarellas of the world. Yeah. And I think what's so incredible about this film is it really has a portrayal of bisexuality that feels, not that it should be thought of as like the norm, but it's a really good example of, I think, some of the pain that can be felt between like bisexuals and other queer people in the queer community. Because I think what this film does really well is shows how brutally people can be treated whose sexuality can be spotted.
Yeah.
You know, can be seen. Because if it can be seen and noticed and observed, then it can be policed.
Yeah.
And if it flies under the radar, and I'm not saying that every bisexual's sexuality flies under the radar, that's definitely depends. But I think Well, let me start actually by just talking about the bisexual character. She doesn't identify as bisexual or as anything, but it's Bina.
Right.
And it's an incredible twist in the script because, you know, Audrey has set up Bina and Alike to try to get Alike away from her butch lesbian friend. To basically, like, it's kind of just like, can I do a kind of straight camp here at home by sending her to hang out with Bina?
And the irony being, Alike and Bina end up sleeping together. So by trying to move Alike away from the queer community, she actually introduced her to her first sexual partner.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Which is a hilarious script twist. That
it's like a Greek tragedy. Like,
it's incredible.
Pure irony.
Yeah. And so Bina actually is the one who initiates their first kiss. Yep. And Bina just overall, like, what's really nice about their friendship is Bina and Alike have, like, things in common that are really different than what Alike and Laura have in common.
Right.
Alike and Laura kind of feel like a friendship. Like, they are deep friends, but it's partly out of, like, survival. You know, they're both queer women.
They watch each other's back.
They have each other's back. They. And Alike and Bina feels more like a friendship of mutual interests.
Right.
Like, especially artistic. They listen to music together. Yeah. They're in the same English class, and Bina likes her poetry.
Right. She's more of a peer, whereas Laura is more of a mentor.
Totally, yeah. And Bina kind of doesn't understand why Alike is so stressed out by her mom getting on her case. Yeah. But Bina doesn't know what it's like to have her body kind of like policed in the way that it is happening to Alike. Alike's mom is really trying to monitor what she's wearing for information about her sexuality and trying to, like, as if putting Alike in a dress will make her straight.
Yeah.
You know, as if that's the, totally. It's causal, you know?
I think that gets to what you were saying earlier. Mm-hmm. And something we've talked about before, I think in our Moonlight episode, we talked about certain people's sexuality just can't be closeted. It really just can't. But then there are people who can code switch. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily correlate to gay, straight, bi, trans, whatever, but it does really impact your experience of the world when you're a queer person, is whether or not everybody else can tell.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're both people who can pass for straight.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
But, you know, I have plenty of friends who can't, who it just doesn't come to them. Mm-hmm. And I think that plays into another real difference between certain queer people, which is their home environment, frankly.
Yeah.
It's obvious to say, but there is a world of difference between somebody who grew up in a household that was accepting of queerness and a household that wasn't. And I think what Bina and Alike's relationship really shows is the different way that those two types of people understand the stakes of queerness.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that Bina's rejection of Alike in the end, of saying, oh, that's just playing, I'm not gay, that is such a brutal, brutal moment. And I don't see that so much as definitively saying anything about Bina's sexuality.
No.
So much as it being like the words spoken from a straight passing person who is really, really not ready to face the world as an out person in any way.
Yeah.
And so is minimizing the way that they feel.
Yeah.
And I think that ability to choose when to come out, when to take those feelings seriously, not that it is always a choice, but to me that really, like, gets at the heart of some of the tension that I sometimes feel and hear from bisexual people versus other queer people. Because I think not all, but a lot of bisexual people have the ability to pass as straight or have passed for straight at some point in their life. And so kind of been spared from certain harm in that case.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we can't speak for every bisexual, just like we can't speak for every queer person, but I can say in my own experience, that's definitely true. I've definitely been able to escape a lot of awkward situations because I could pass for straight. And I think we should be clear, that's not to put the blame on the person who passes. it's just something that needs to be recognized, frankly. The only real danger is if you don't recognize that as a privilege, because it is.
Yeah, and I think it's important to think about what that means and then to think about the way that you move in the world. But I'm similar. I remember at an old job, I just like never came out because I just didn't have to. And I kind of felt like I just don't want to in this space. And I think a lot of like the language around coming out is really flawed. I don't think queer people owe coming out in any space. But I also think that obviously that's like a huge privilege for me to be able to decide, you know, I'm not interested. And then I say like I wasn't hiding anything either. Like I would never have like lied if someone had asked or anything. But yeah, I don't know. It definitely affects the way that I move through the world and definitely affects certain. This is a very small thing, but for example, my friend sent me like a writer's workshop you can apply to that's like for queer writers. I don't know that that's something I feel comfortable applying to, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, but I mean, in that particular instance, I would say you are a queer writer, so.
Yes, 100%. I think what I mean is that like I am in a relationship with a man right now. Mm-hmm. And like for the foreseeable future. And so much of my life is just straight for all intents in terms of like the privilege or not in terms of like, how can I say this? Maybe that's a bad example.
In terms of perception.
Yes. And I think bringing it back to the actual film, I just think the conflict between Bina and Alike demonstrates so many complex and challenging things about the way that different queer people experience the world and have really different challenges and sometimes less severe challenges. Yeah. And I just think that's such a huge thing to tackle through a really personal lens of just two people having a coming together and coming apart.
Yeah. And to give the film credit, it definitely doesn't feel targeted at bisexuals in general.
No.
It just feels much more like an observation of what different high school experiences can be like.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I will say, Bina's line, "I'm not gay." It reminds me of the way that back before I was out, I just sort of denied my bisexuality to myself. I never even acknowledged it in private. Mm-hmm. And that was, in hindsight, I can very easily see how that was a defense mechanism. You know, that was self-protection. And I say that not to judge myself. You know, I could not have survived being a Boy Scout in Virginia if I had known I was bi. Because anytime somebody called me the F slur, it would have hit.
Yeah.
You know? And in that environment, you get called that a lot. You hear that a lot.
Yeah.
People say that a lot. You know, walking on the street in New York, getting called that, you know, for telling a catcaller to shut the fuck up, you know? Mm-hmm. Back before I was out to myself, I could laugh it off because I knew they were just flailing, looking for something to say to hurt me.
Yeah.
But when I came out, it hit, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Because suddenly you know that it does apply to you. And, you know, that's a product of privilege. And I recognize that in some ways I was lucky, not lucky. I mean, that was the reason why. That was the reason why I suppressed those ideas, you know? Because I knew I couldn't handle being out yet. But the fact that I was able to avoid it for such a long time was a privilege.
Right.
And not one that everybody enjoys.
And I think that's just kind of, I saw this little Twitter fight flare up briefly last week where a bisexual author had a book of hers rejected because she was married to a man. Mm. And whoever she'd submitted it to had been really interested and then had found out she was married to a man and was like, I can't really publish this book where like the primary romance is between two women given. Mm. And she went on Twitter and was really like, obviously upset. She was like, she was like, you know, bisexual people are sometimes in
hetero relationships.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it was really interesting because as Twitter will often do, there was the initial argument that people agreed with and there was backlash and there were some queer writers who were really like, no offense, but the privilege that bisexual people have in passing for straight, it's like, yes, this is annoying. This person rejected your book, but like also, you know, that I think how many trans women writers can you name? how many non-binary writers.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I agree with that argument. I just think that when you see tensions like that flaring up,
yeah,
I think of this relationship in this movie. I feel like it encapsulates so much of the kind of resentments that can build up.
I actually disagree with you on that one.
Okay. Disagree.
I think that this relationship in this film is very true. I don't think it's true of the larger queer community. To be honest, that story you just told about the author getting rejected, that still reads as biphobia to me.
Oh, it is. Like, it is.
Well, no, it is. I'm not saying you're not recognizing that, but I think that's completely different from this relationship, because when someone is an out bisexual, that's very different than being a closeted one. You know, you are, when you come out, you are in some ways resigning the ability to pass, especially as a public figure, like an author. If it is a known fact that you're bi, you are not hiding it, then yeah, like, I don't think anybody could accuse you, even if others still perceive you as being straight, that's not on you. That's their assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that particular, without having ever heard of that Twitter beef before, because we're on different sectors of the app, we're in different circles of hell.
Truly, I thought it would be fun to follow more writers on Twitter, and it's horrible.
Yeah.
No, it's literally horrible.
Yeah. I only follow lefties on Twitter because it's at least arguments are more educational. That reads more as erasing somebody's bisexuality, erasing somebody's queerness, which is very different. And the tension between bisexuals and other queer people is not limited to the question of passing.
Yes, yes.
There's a lot of other factors that go into that.
That's true.
And a lot of history that goes into that, which doesn't all cut one way. Not trying to say that bisexuals are saints.
No, it's very, very true.
But yeah.
I think I just mean that, like, this portrayal to me more than others is not like a villainizing portrayal.
Sure.
You know, I don't know. To me, it's just a more human, more realistic portrayal of like the actual pain and hurt that might occur between someone who can pass and someone who can't in any sense.
I agree with you there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't think it applies on a larger scale. That's all I mean.
Totally. Totally.
I think that scene is a great example of how characters with different understandings of the stakes can be really interesting, and how when people have different understandings of stakes, we can really hurt each other in ways that we don't intend to. Like I can easily imagine, you know, a 10 years later sort of film where, you know, maybe Bina is still in the closet and, you know, isn't out and still denies that, you know, the time she spent with Alike meant anything. Or maybe she is out. Maybe she really regrets the way she treated Alike.
Yeah.
No, that's the thing. This is a movie about 17-year-olds. It's a coming of age story.
Totally.
And so the ways in which Bina is shitty are very specific to the way 17-year-olds are shitty, where they're thinking about themselves. They're thinking about their self, the way they are perceived by others.
Yeah.
And they end up really hurting each other.
And there's lots of like very hurtful relationships that play out similarly, even between like straight people. I mean, there's an entire,
absolutely.
You know, Sally Rooney book about a boy and a girl.
That's the thing. Yeah, we all hurt each other, queer or straight.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And that's the thing. And I definitely don't want, you know, we started this episode talking about the humor in this film. And I think that that's a really important through line, because this isn't a queer trauma narrative.
No.
I think that that's really important, because there are some films that are trying to be good queer representation, but instead make it seem like we're all tortured and that straight people are all fine normies. Yeah. When really no one's happy. No one's happy.
Yeah. We should talk really quickly about the ending of the film, I think.
Yeah, I'd love to. I love the ending of this movie, because I think it reframes a common experience for queer people in a much more positive way than it's usually presented, which is leaving home for good.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times in cinema and fiction, running away from home or leaving home is presented as tragic or sad or, you know, really heartbreaking, when for a lot of queer people, it's a release and a relief. I think Alike says it to her dad and then repeats it in the poem that serves as the film's epilogue, which is that she's not running, she's choosing. And I think that it's really valuable and important to portray that decision as a decision rather than as, you know, a failure of some kind. You know, I think Alike's decision to leave home and to never come back is fully reasonable given the circumstances. And the film does a really good job of setting it up as her stepping into her life rather than running away from it.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful way to put it. And I think the poem she reads at the end, all about that, I think ends with the line, "I'm not running, I'm choosing," or at least contains it. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I feel like empowering isn't the right word, because I feel like empowering is a word that's getting thrown around all the time right now. Yeah. Like, and us a lot,
it's
by
very
brands.
Thoroughly recuperated by the capitalist bourgeois media.
Yeah. But I do feel like what's so beautiful about it is that this story is so much about Alike figuring out who she is and finding herself, so that in the end, when she does arrive at kind of an understanding of herself, it doesn't matter how much she's lost, almost, because what she's gained is so much greater. It's her, you know?
Yeah.
And there's this scene where her sister and her dad and mom are all having dinner and she's not there.
Yeah.
And you definitely don't feel like Alike is really missing out on this dinner.
Yeah.
You feel like, God, I can't wait till Sharonda can get out of there too. You know, you feel like
exactly.
It's horrific the way that she is forced to leave her home.
Yeah.
Through violence. And yet she is so steadfast in herself, in her conversation with her father, where he asks her to come home. And she's like, fucking no, dude, you know? And it is really great.
No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that scene in particular is such masterful writing, because it really does frame it that way, as if the one thing worth saving in that family was Alike, and now that she's gone, it should just be disbanded. Because, you know, I think a lot of times when in a film, when somebody runs away from home, you get a shot of their family having dinner together, and oh, you know, they're on the outside, and oh, they wish they could go home. And instead, this is reframing that exact image, the family dinner, as, oh, this is a torture chamber that you got out of, good for you.
Yeah. And also, like, I love it too, because I think in so many narratives, whether like queer or not, where families are separated for whatever reason, but like, especially when there's conflict, there's so much emphasis placed on resolving the conflict, reuniting the family.
Yeah.
And what I love about this film is like the message is kind of like, you are not owed a familial relationship.
Yeah.
Like if you are a mother and you mistreat your children, you are not owed their reconciliation.
Yeah.
And like, it doesn't even have to be more than like this one incident that would make that person walk out and choose to not interact with you anymore.
Hell, it doesn't even have to culminate in physical
violence. Right, exactly.
And if you don't give love, you don't get love.
Yeah. I will say the only part of the ending that I had a little trouble with was just that it was such a sudden move to California.
Mm, but I see what you mean.
Yeah. But like every other time I've watched it, it's never bothered me. I think just now that I'm in California, I just feel like, wait a second. Now you're randomly, we never even talked about this. But that's like an extremely petty quibble that I say upon my fourth viewing.
That's fair. I think
it feels like a bit like a deus ex machina, you know?
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't go so far as to call it deus ex machina, because she is a high school senior and so much time is spent on education as a subplot, both hers and Laura's attempts to get a GED. It's not outside the universe of this film for her to get into college.
No,
college
totally.
Is a very common escape route for a lot of queer teenagers is, okay, I'm going to go to school now, later.
Yeah. No, I think it wasn't the even getting into college. I think it was just that it was an early college program.
Sure.
I think it was just the timing of it that aligned. I mean, it's beautifully done in the film. It's perfectly done because she just gets to say, fuck you, New York, fuck you, family. I'm heading to the sun now.
Yeah, I'm still willing to let it pass. I think because you know what the alternative is? The alternative is that they set it up really clunkily in an earlier scene where her teacher's like, when are you getting the application in for the early program at Berkeley?
That's very true. That's very true.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Like I'd rather have a good payoff than, you know,
clunky,
manufactured setup.
Preview. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. That's it. It's your mileage may vary. I see what you mean.
Well, it's only on fourth viewing, you know. But a beautiful film. A beautiful film.
Absolutely. I look forward to my fourth viewing of this film because it was absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. It really is good every single time.
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of covered everything about this film. And that means there's only one thing left.
Absolutely. Our tradition that I would never forget and then cut out the evidence that I forgot it.
Yeah. Fuck, marry, kill.
Yes.
I think we should do.
Yeah. Who do you want to include in our trio?
I don't know. It's weird because they're like all high schoolers.
Yeah. Let's not include the kids.
Yeah. I think so the teacher, the AP English teacher, we should definitely include. Yes.
Who's, I forget that actor's name, but she's like a well-regarded character actor. She's in a bunch of stuff. I mean, if we include either of her parents, I'm probably going to kill them.
Kill them both. Kill them both. Yeah.
just because the way they treat Alike.
What if we just do the high school version of the game, which is like you have a crush on them, you take them to prom, or you kill them.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay.
All right. So in that case, do we want to do Bina, our bisexual?
Definitely.
Laura.
Yeah.
And then I think Alike is
the only third person.
Yeah. So I think Bina, Laura, Alike.
Yeah. So do crush,
prom, kill.
Kill. Okay, I guess we could do detention, but it's kind of funny to do kill.
No. I think my experience of high schooler was my experience of high school was barely suppressed rage. So
Yeah.
All right. I think I've got mine.
I think I got mine too.
I'll go. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah. So I think I would definitely have a crush on Laura. Mm-hmm. Like so confident, so just like so fun. Also so sweet the way she wanted to make sure Alike got home safe and was going to ride the bus.
Yeah.
I think I would go to prom with Alike because she's so shy and sweet and would love her poems. And I'd have to kill Bina for being, I guess that's bi on bi violence, but I'd have to do it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I would also kill Bina because, you know, as much as I can say, like, oh, she's a kid, blah, 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 don't know. She still fucking sucks. She still sucks. Even if she might not suck later in life, she still sucks now.
Yeah.
Then I actually think I would go to prom with Laura because we would have a baller time. Like, we would smuggle whiskey in and just like.
Yes. Paint definitely. The town red. She has that energy. Yeah.
Yeah. It would definitely, like, she's also very clearly not into the dude type, so it would be a platonic prom date.
Yes, right, which is honestly the most fun.
Yeah, and then I think high school me would have had a crush on Alike, and then, of course, like, been heartbroken to realize that she was not into my entire deal. but yeah, like, I mean, for one thing, the actress is just so pretty.
Adepero
Adoya. Like, just so pretty, and she's a poet, and honestly, like, her performance is so charismatic.
It's
this
insane.
Whole movie. She is electrifying.
I think that's what keeps me coming back and rewatching. Like, yeah. I just
her
can't get enough.
Is just incredible. And she was 30 when she played this high school student. I looked it up
that's
later.
That's hilarious.
That's insane. I mean, it's I'm incredible. So used to being like, yep, that's a 30-year-old playing a high school student, but she totally sells it.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
But yeah, that's my trio.
Love it. Cool. Everyone watch this movie. It's on Criterion.
Yep. It's so good. It's pretty widely available. I rented it on Amazon. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, highly, highly recommend it as somebody who's only seen it once.
Yeah. You know, if you like the show, if you want to hear more, or you just have way too much money on your hands, you can check out our Patreon.
Patreon.com/snailsoysters. Can't do an ampersand in a.
Right, that makes sense. You'll get bonus episodes, one bonus episode a month.
Yep.
Nat and I are slowly working through our top 50 movies, and Nat is also throwing up movie reviews.
By the time this episode comes out, I believe our second bonus episode on the Merchant Ivory film, A Room with a View, should be out. That was my first pick, so you can check that out if you subscribe to the Patreon. We also want to thank Billy Libby for our wonderful theme music and Abby Austin for our fantastic artwork. You can find links to both their social medias in the episode description.
You can find us on Twitter, too. We're at Snails Oysters. Tell us what you think. Throw us, you know, DM us a movie you want us to do. Tell us you hate our takes.
Tell us you love our takes.
Tell us you love our takes.
Actually, you know what? Don't tell us if you hate our takes. I'm gonna go on the record and say only tell us if you like it.
setting boundaries. I love that.
But thank you so much for listening. And as always, thank you
for being a bi-ally.
I hope it's always clear that that's a joke.